Welcome to the Ad Nauseam Podcast, where classical gourmands everywhere can finally get their fill. Join us for a delectable discussion of Greco-Roman civilization stretching from the Minoans and Mycenaeans through the Renaissance and right down to the present. And now, ladies and gentlemen, here are your hosts, Dr. David Noe and Dr. Jeff Winkle.
Good afternoon, listeners. We're coming to you live from the Vomitorium, our studios in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Good afternoon, Jeff.
Good afternoon, David. How are you doing?
I'm real well, thanks. So this is episode 4. We're going to wrap up our look at the Iliad from an artistic perspective.
That's right.
And episode 4, of course, The Phantom Menace.
The Phantom Menace, right, which was the 4th Star Wars film.
Or was it the first?
Well, I think it's technically the first, but it was also the 4th.
What was the most memorable character for you in that one?
Oh, it's got to be Jar Jar.
Definitely
everybody's
Jar Jar.
Favorite character.
Absolutely.
That's right. All right. It's actually, so maybe if we can squeeze it in, we can think about who's the Homeric Jar Jar.
The Homeric Jar Jar. Yeah. I would suggest Thersites.
Thersites.
Book 2. Interesting character. Hopefully now all the listeners are running to Google, the Oracle of Google, and finding out who Thersites is.
Maybe we can just say that he gets a severe beatdown.
He does.
In the way that lots of Star Wars fans would have loved to have seen Jar Jar get a similar kind of comeuppance.
There's no doubt about that.
That's right. So hey, as we before we get into the meat of this, I believe you have another opening quote for us.
I do. This one is from Bernard Knox. He wrote this in 1993 in his famous work, The Oldest Dead White European Males. Can you relate, Jeff?
I can, except to a lot of those adjectives.
You got several of those, right?
Yes, I do.
Getting older, white, European, and so forth, but not quite dead.
No.
So Bernard Knox says, only Shakespeare can compete with Homer in this extraordinary power to impose his fictional personalities on the imagination of succeeding ages. Only scholars, and I speak of them with sympathy since I am one myself, could bring themselves to deny Homer the power to create literary character in the fullest sense of the words, in defiance of the brute fact that Homer's characters have fascinated and obsessed writers and readers for some 2,500 years, longer than any other such set of personalities except the characters of the Hebrew Old Testament.
So Homer's important.
Absolutely.
Right, and I love his little kind of dig at himself and scholars. It's only scholars could deny that. Only
I would say that. Absolutely. Any scholar who's not self-mocking is not a scholar worth listening to.
Oh, I like that. Yes, I'd buy that as well.
Okay.
So what are we talking about today? Well, you wanted to give some shout-outs before we dive in. Please do so.
Yeah, we have a well-loved listener in Melbourne, Australia. I'd like to say good day to Janet Norman, a very ardent, devoted student of the classics. She's been reading Cicero and Sallust, been working on some Greek. Also DP, a man who goes only by initials in Chicago, very diligent listener and student of the classics. And finally, Heather in California, reading some Sallust, some Cicero, some Lysias, the Greek orator, working on her Greek and Latin with great diligence.
Fabulous. We're wrapping up Homer today.
Yep.
The look at the Iliad, but our discussion of Homer and the world of Homer is not going to end here, right?
No, of course
so
not.
Where are we going with this?
In future episodes. Sure. The next few episodes are going to look at some of the historical archaeological background to the Iliad and Odyssey, the Minoans and the Mycenaeans. Now, without giving away too much, the Minoans, the culture centered on Crete.
That's right.
Discovered by a man named Sir Arthur Evans.
Right.
And the Mycenaeans, of course, Heinrich Schliemann on the Greek mainland and in the Middle East, in Turkey, in lots of different places.
Right.
So was there a Homer? Are these events historical in some sense?
Was there a Trojan War? Right.
Was it fought over a woman?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. So those are the things we're going to look at in future episodes. But for today, we're going to wrap up by looking at 4 books.
Yes.
16, 18, 22, and 24.
That's right. We're going to center our discussion around looking at kind of questions of fate and destiny in the Iliad, the role of the gods in that. We're going to be considering Achilles' shield, the new armor made for him by the god Hephaestus, the climactic duel between Achilles and Hector, and finally the ransoming of Hector's body back to his father, which brings us to the close of the epic. So we're going to end at the ending.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So book 16, Patroclus comes into battle. And Jeff, I understand that you're going to share with us a few things about the Superman paradox from the 1978 movie.
Exactly. Well, one of the things I find so fascinating about the Iliad and really about kind of Greek mythology as a whole is this the relationship between kind of the impersonal fate and the role of the gods, and how powerful is Zeus even within that schematic? Who's controlling destiny? And I think it's a really important question that weighs heavily on the Iliad. And I don't think Homer really answers that question, but he's clearly interested in it. So I wanted to call attention to, there's a great scene in Book 16 where Patroclus is in the middle of his Aristeia. He's out killing people on the battlefield.
The Aristeia, the moment of keenest glory for an individual hero, where his mettle, his valor, his strength, his wits, all these things are tested and on display for the whole world to see.
Exactly, as we saw with Diomedes.
Right, in Book 6.
And Aeneas and Hector have a similar kind of scene. So this is Patroclus' moment on the stage.
Which translation are you reading from?
I am reading from Robert Fagel's translation. And there's a scene where kind of the camera zooms up to Olympus. And Zeus, having some sort of kind of insight into fate and what's about to happen, he recognized that one of his sons, Sarpedon, one of his mortal sons, is about to die.
And Sarpedon is a Trojan hero.
That is
or
correct.
Or at least he's fighting on the side of the Trojans.
Side of the Trojans.
He's one of the allies from the Hittite region of northwest Turkey.
Yes, yes. And Zeus sees that he's about to die, and he doesn't like it. So Zeus, being Zeus, says, what if I just pluck him up and put him back home?
He has ambrosial locks, as Homer likes to say. He's got curly hair, hangs down from his forehead,
yes.
Smells like ambrosia because that's what he eats, right?
That's right.
You are what you eat, or you smell what you eat.
Exactly.
And if he nods his head, he shakes those ambrosial locks, then all of human destiny has to fall in line.
That's right. Exactly.
So why does Zeus decide not to do that in this instance?
Well, he's kind of thinking out loud, and his wife / sister, Hera, hears him speaking. And this is, let me read from the Fagel's translation. She says, "Dread Majesty, son of Cronos, what are you saying? A man, a mere mortal, his doom sealed long ago? You'd set him free from all the pains of death? Well, do as you please, Zeus. But none of the deathless gods will ever praise you. And I tell you this, take it to heart, I urge you. If you send Sarpedon home living still, beware. Then surely some other god will want to sweep his own son clear of the heavy fighting too. Look down. Many who battle around King Priam's mighty walls are sons of the deathless gods. You will inspire lethal anger in them all." So Hera seems to suggest that to Zeus, that if he wants to, he can do it.
Mm-hmm.
But he's opening up Pandora's box.
The floodgates.
The floodgates. And all the other gods will do it. And I mean, perhaps I'm reading into it, but I see in that kind of the sense that Hera's saying that if you do so, you're messing with powers that even Zeus, you shouldn't be messing with.
Right. So there is some sense in which even the king of the gods, in what is called a henotheistic system.
Yes.
So it's polytheistic, lots and lots of gods, but there's one god who rules over all the others. That's
right.
A kind of henotheism. I think the term is Walter Müller. Even in a henotheistic system, Zeus himself is subordinated to some higher power.
Right, exactly.
The fates.
Exactly right. He has insight into it. He can maybe tinker around the edges, but at the end of the day, even Zeus has to bend the knee.
So Hera says, don't do it, because it might look like a short-term gain, but long-term, chaos.
Exactly right.
Everyone will save their favorite.
Exactly right. And this might be the one time in all of Greek myth where Zeus actually listens to his wife.
Shows some self-restraint.
Right. And he allows Sarpedon to go to his death, which is extraordinary. And so you mentioned this so-called Superman paradox. And this scene has always reminded me of a moment or a set of moments from the Superman film 1978, Christopher Reeve.
Right.
Kind of the first Superman blockbuster film. And it's...
Was Richard Pryor in that one?
No, that was Superman 3.
Okay.
There was some kind of volcano involved.
All right.
Horrible, horrible film.
Okay.
Right.
Well, great actor.
Yeah.
I would say Pryor.
Pryor, a great stand-up comedian. Not a great actor.
Okay.
Right. So anyways, in that film, it's Superman's origin story.
Mm-hmm.
And long story short, he has his Fortress of Solitude. And in that Fortress of Solitude, he can plug in these crystals by which he gets advice from his dead father.
Jor-El.
Marlon Brando, phoning it in.
Right.
Big time.
Jor-El. That's what I usually use on my countertops to keep them clean.
Oh, it works wonders.
A little bit of Jor-El.
Exactly. You know, you can, when you see yourself in the countertop, you know you're using Jor-El.
That's right.
So one of the things that Marlon Brando tells him is that he says, son, you're going to be like a god amongst these people. And you have such powers that you can even mess with time and destiny and fate.
Those three in particular.
Those three in particular.
Time, destiny, and fate.
Right. It's not just flying around and leaping tall buildings. It's you have these tremendous powers. And he says, however, that's forbidden. You don't cross that line.
Hmm.
So zoom forward to the end of the film. Lois Lane, her car gets caught in a earthquake.
Margot Kidder, is that?
Margot Kidder, yes, exactly right.
I think so.
Yes, Margot Kidder.
Okay.
And her car gets sucked down into a crevice and she dies. And Superman, he's been saving everybody else, but he comes and he finds Lois Lane dead too late. So what does Superman do? As Superman can do, he flies around the world
backwards, right,
and reverses the Earth's spin.
He goes back in time and sees his own shadow.
Exactly right.
8 more years of winter.
That's right. Exactly right. So I never took a physics course beyond high school, but then,
right,
you know, turning the Earth,
it works.
You reverse the spin, you
give
turn time back, right?
Give it a try, it works.
So, and as he's flying up, before he does it, he hears kind of echoing in his memory, he hears his father say, it is forbidden.
Right.
But he does it anyway.
It's a great Brando, by the way.
Thank you.
It is forbidden. Let me tell you something.
Just the range of that guy. But he does it anyway. Brings Lois Lane back to life, and they have kind of this goofy reunion scene. But of course, what the film never answers is that he's just crossed this line.
How could he do that? Right.
But and that's where I think it's so fascinating, where kind of the Greek myth and the American myth part ways. Where for the Greeks, Zeus steps down. He recognizes who's in charge. And in the Superman film, it's like in any Disney film.
Right.
It's romantic love that's the highest power of all.
There is no higher power than romantic love.
Exactly right. Right.
So Ovid seems to believe this. The Roman poet Ovid, end of the 1st century BC, beginning of the 1st century AD. Ovid seems to believe in this power of romantic love. But that's a future episode.
Mm-hmm.
Back to Homer.
Yeah.
Homer says, not even love for one's son, Sarpedon, is strong enough to trump the fates.
Right, that's right. It's brutal. That's right. It's a constant reminder of how tragedy and death-focused this epic is. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so let's bring this back around to Patroclus and his Aristeia. And how do you see kind of this notion of fate and destiny playing into kind of his last scenes?
Right. So Patroclus is the distant relative of Achilles, the cousin, the very close friend, the tent mate while Achilles is glamping on the plain.
Mm-hmm.
And Patroclus wants his own glory. He knows he's not as great a hero, a warrior as Achilles, but like all the great heroes, he's motivated by the desire for fame. He has been loyal thus far to Achilles, but eventually he says, look, Achilles, Hector is causing havoc among our forces, the Myrmidons, and I would like to go out on the plain as well and earn some glory for myself. Achilles replies, take my armor.
Right, right. So he goes out there and it kind of, he has his moment on the stage, but it's kind of a borrowed glory too, because all the Trojans think, seeing this man in the shiny black armor, Achilles is back. And so the Trojans panic in the face of that. And how does Hector respond?
So Achilles is not going back to war.
No.
But he's going to give Patroclus his armor.
That's right.
He wants his friend to be well prepared for the fight. He does add this little bit in as well. He gives a rousing speech to his Myrmidons, his assembled warriors, as they go back into battle with Patroclus. It's a speech filled with fire and valor. It's very dramatic. But then as Fitzgerald says in his translation, this very pithy line, when the speech is over, quote, Achilles went to his hut.
So he's going back to glamp.
That's right.
He's decamping.
He's going to pout because, after all, there's nothing yet that has been a strong enough lever to get him back on the battlefield.
Right.
But all that will change in this book.
That's right.
And how does that change, Jeff?
So it's coming very, very soon. So Patroclus goes out. He has his Aristeia. He has some success against his enemies, pushing the Trojans back. The Trojans think that it's Achilles coming back against them.
A case of mistaken identity.
That's exactly right.
Wearing the black armor of Achilles.
That's right.
Very impressive.
Yes. And this gets the attention of Hector. And ultimately, Hector makes a beeline for Patroclus. And it's that duel that ultimately brings about the end of Patroclus and setting the forces in motion to bring Achilles back to the battle.
That's right. So I have this little quote here from the Bryant translation. This is right near the end of Book 16. Now, Patroclus is wounded, but, as Bryant says, but Hector, when he saw the gallant Greek thus wounded and retreating, left his place among the squadrons and advancing, pierced Patroclus with his spear below the belt, driving the weapon deep.
Low blow.
That is a low blow. The
yes.
hero fell with clashing mail, and all the Greeks beheld his fall with grief. As when a lion bears a stubborn boar to earth, what time the twain fight on the mountains for a slender spring, both thirsty and both fierce, the lion's strength lays prone his panting foe. So Priam's son slew fighting hand to hand, the valiant Greek, the son of Menoetius, who himself had slain so many. So the son of Priam, Hector, the son of Menoetius, Patroclus. Now Patroclus is dead. Hector will go on to give a little taunt of victory over the body of Patroclus. But these are words he's going to rue, because this is what leverages Achilles back onto the field. And how does that work?
Well, this is, like you were saying, is that Achilles up to this point has not had anything to really push him back to the battle. But the loss of Patroclus is the last straw.
Mm-hmm.
This will kind of force him back out into the battlefield. And Hector's vaunting over Patroclus's body will soon be answered by Achilles' renewed and amped up rage, which ultimately will come for Hector himself.
Hmm. And Patroclus has his own ending words right at the end of book 16, doesn't he, Jeff? Can
he
you
does.
Read those from the Fitzgerald?
Yes. From the Fagles translation.
Fagles.
Right, so Fagles translates, struggling for breath, you answered, Patroclus, O my rider. And note that, too, that Patroclus is one of those handful of characters that Homer uses, that personal you.
That's right. It's called apostrophe, when the author speaks to one of the characters. And that's rare. You're right.
Right. And so it's said that Patroclus is one of those characters that Homer, quote-unquote, likes.
Mm-hmm.
Right. This is what Patroclus says. Hector, now is your time to glory to the skies. Now the victory is yours. A gift of the son of Cronos, Zeus, Apollo, too. They brought me down with all their deathless ease. They are the ones who tore the armor off my back. Even if 20 Hectors had charged against me, they'd have all died here, laid low by my spear. No deadly fate in league with Apollo killed me. From the ranks of men, Euphorbus, you came third, and all you could do was finish off my life. One more thing. Take it to heart, I urge you. You too. You won't live long yourself, I swear. Already I see them looming up beside you. Death and the strong force of fate to bring you down at the hands of Aeacus' great royal son, Achilles.
Hmm.
So it's an extraordinary little speech. So Patroclus basically says to Hector, now's your time for glory, but he also says, yeah, but you didn't really do it. The gods did this.
The gods did it. Hector, yep. You may have won the moment, but death is stalking you in the form of Achilles.
Right.
You're going to lose the war.
Right. So he has that kind of clarity that you often see in legends, that you know, the last words of a character, the last moments of a character are often imbued with a kind of second sight. And Patroclus sees very clearly who has done what and what's about to happen.
There's a great painting from 1803, a painter named Fuseli, and it shows the soul of Patroclus leaving his body. If you want to look it up, it's F-U-S-E-L-I, Fuseli.
Excellent.
And the soul of Patroclus leaving his body, but not before he issues these prophetic words.
Right. Now Achilles is, when he learns of this, his main end goes into overdrive.
Yeah, he's torqued.
Right. But the problem is that Hector has stripped Patroclus' body of Achilles' own armor.
Mm-hmm.
And so Achilles doesn't have armor to go back into the fight himself. So
He
goes to Mama.
As and he says, Mom, I'm ready to go back to war. I know my fate is sealed. I'm going to die. I can't go back and live a happy life in my homeland. I got to die here. But I'm going to get revenge on Hector for killing my best friend,
That's
Patroclus.
Right.
But I need some armor. Thetis then sets in motion a chain of events which delivers him a brand new package of armor.
Yes, from whom?
From Hephaestus,
yes.
The smith god.
Right, and so the ultimate craftsman makes the ultimate armor for Achilles.
He's got an iPhone 12, if I'm not mistaken.
Absolutely right, exactly. All gold-plated,
mm-hmm.
All the bells and whistles.
So what is most unique about the armor of Achilles as presented in Book 18? We have an ekphrasis, right?
We do have an ekphrasis, right. And so it's the in Western literature, it's the first ekphrasis. So what is an ekphrasis? It's literally a speaking out. Usually defines something like an extended description of a static work of art,
mm-hmm.
or an object, which will often take on a life of its own. And in this book, it's a description of Achilles' shield.
And it comes to be a kind of a badge or stamp or seal of the author's identity. Actually, the ekphrasis, like you say, the speaking out of or description of a work of art, of an artifact, comes to be that thing which identifies the author. So this ekphrasis is an amazing shield on which are relief figures of various aspects of human life and society.
Right.
So what does Hephaestus put on this shield that Achilles is going to carry back into battle?
Well, it's extraordinary. In Homer's description, the shield takes on a life of its own. It really becomes kind of a mini movie with many different little scenes. And so we have farming scenes, we have plowing scenes, we have the sky, the stars and the moon, we have scenes of cattle and herdsmen, young women dancing.
So the whole shield has around it a blue band.
Yes.
A nice blue band, which is the river ocean.
Right.
And then in concentric circles, as we go down into the center, we have all of these things that you're describing.
Right.
We have dancing is the next band after the river ocean. Then we have herdsmen, cattle, sheep, and a lion.
And all kinds of things that, when I read this description of the shield, it takes you out of the main action. In a really, I think at a glance, kind of a puzzling kind of way. I mean, one of the things that I think often strikes the first reader of the Iliad is, why are these things on the shield?
Mm-hmm.
You'd expect like a big gaping head of Medusa
right.
on the shield, or something that...
As on the shield of Perseus you're referencing.
Exactly right. Or something that kind of underscores, you know, the bloody and violent nature of combat. But you get these, in many ways, kind of these domestic rural scenes.
Yeah, I should say, correction there, I should say, as on the shield of Athena, with the head that Perseus gave her.
Yes, the aegis.
Right.
Yes.
But we have these really interesting scenes, which are a portrait, a microcosm of all human society. The whole world is bounded by the river ocean.
Right.
And once you get in within the dancing, we have all of these different aspects of human culture and activity, of human livelihood, plowing, reaping, the making of wine, and sacrifice. And then right near the center, we have a city at war, and a city at peace, both of these cities in a kind of constant conflict.
Yes, exactly. I'm eager to kind of hear your take on this, trying to answer this question of why does Hephaestus put these things on the shield? What's the story here? What's the message here?
I think the message which both the Greeks took from this and which they contributed to, Homer is at the same time a reflection of Greek culture and the standard bearer, you might say, the teacher of Greek culture, and that is that the condition of war is common for human experience.
Yeah.
War is the standard condition. The city at war and the city at peace are constantly in conflict. War is not unnatural to human life. It's the basis of human life. In fact, Homer will say, war is the father of all things. All technology, all athletics, all romance, all literature, all of these things flow from the broken condition of warfare.
Interesting.
The city at peace is in conflict with the city of war at all times. And these are at the very center of human experience in the same way that these two pictures, the city at war, the city at peace, are at the center of the shield.
Right.
And in the very center of the shield is the natural world, the sky, the sea, the stars, the sun, the moon.
Yeah.
So we tend to think of the natural state of life, I would say, moderns, as being one of peace. And war is an exception.
Right.
The Greeks seem to have had the opposite outlook on human society.
Sure, exactly right. So yeah, that's great. I like that interpretation a lot. I also like this more kind of individualized reading that suggests that we might even see Achilles as he picks up the shield. In some ways, he's kind of picking up that choice of fates that he had, right? I think when I read all the scenes that are on the shield, the vast majority of them are actually quite peaceful,
yeah,
quite
absolutely.
Mundane, quite rural. And so maybe it kind of underlines the tragedy is that Achilles picks up the shield and what's on the shield is the destiny that's lost for him, that return home to the quiet rural life. And so
the life he never wanted to leave, actually.
Yeah.
He was brought into the war against his will.
Exactly right. And so that it's deeply tragic. Deeply sad.
Absolutely.
Right.
Well, this is what marks out the ancient heroes, I would say, is that they, and Aeneas, we see this also very much, is that they do what they have to, even if they don't like to.
Right. Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. Another thing I really like in this scene is, actually dips into the beginning of book 19, where the armor is delivered to Achilles, and the way that both Achilles' men and Achilles himself react to the shield. Let me just read a little bit from the beginning of book 19, and this is where Achilles' mother lays the armor down before him.
This is the Jane Austen translation?
The Jane Austen translation, yes, exactly right. Urging, the goddess laid the armor down at Achilles' feet, and the gear clashed all out in all its blazoned glory. A tremor ran through all the Myrmidon ranks. None dared to look straight at the glare. Each fighter shrank away, not Achilles. The more he gazed, the deeper his anger went, his eyes flashing under his eyelids, fierce as fire.
Hmm.
I love that. I love that kind of almost Medusa-like quality that his men can't even look at the armor.
Right.
And in my reading here, I imagine kind of their vision focused on the shield, and the living, breathing aspect of the shield. It's so otherworldly
right.
that Achilles' men can't even bring themselves to look at it.
And it has itself had a long life in Western lit and Western culture, because it will be reprised in the Aeneid. It'll be reprised in Ovid,
yeah.
But instead of a shield in Ovid, it's the doors of the Palace of the Sun.
Right.
The doors of Ghiberti, which are in Florence. These are kind of an homage to Achilles' shield.
Yes.
The idea that on some practical, functional piece of equipment, you put some entirely superfluous decoration.
Right.
And the decoration, which is meant to tell a story.
Right.
A coherent narrative. It's an amazing work of art.
Yes. All right. For the sake of wrapping this up, we're going to move along to the main event, which takes place in Book 22. But before we do that, some words from our sponsor, I believe.
Right, Jeff. So in the second episode, we had a kind of a voiceover commercial for this Greek offering that we have called the Moss Method. And this is one of the offerings from Latin Per Diem.
So tell us a little bit about Latin Per Diem. What exactly is that?
So I've been trying for the last 4 to 5 years to build an international fellowship, you might say, for the study of Greek and Latin. So Latin Per Diem is a website that gives out free Latin lessons, these little 3 to 4 minute clips each day. You can find us on YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, all the typical social media outlets. And then I've added something, shameless plug, more recently called the Moss Method, which is a way to study Greek.
And you can actually learn Latin and Greek?
You can learn Latin and Greek this way, and most of it, about 95% of it, is absolutely free. There's more than 1,500 short little videos at YouTube for studying original Latin authors. You can look at the first couple lines of Homer's Iliad in Greek if you want to.
And where can our audience find these things?
Well, this would be at latinperdiem.com and also at mossmethod.com.
Excellent.
So I encourage you to go there, check it out, and see if you want to join us in the study of Greek and Latin.
All right, so we're getting to the climax of the book, Book 22. Things have been pointing this way for quite some time. It's going to come down to a duel between the primary warriors on both sides. Achilles with his new armor against Hector, who is the best of the Trojan warriors. David, tell us, how does this play out? What happens here?
Well, Achilles' main epithet is swift-footed. As we mentioned in an earlier episode, podas okous, that is, he's very fast. And typical armor for the Homeric heroes is that they wear a breastplate, they have a small shield, they have a spear and a sword, and then they have greaves. And this is a kind of shin guard, and it's actually one of the epithets of the Achaeans as a whole, that they are well-greaved. Euknemides, I think, is the Greek word, and that is they have these bronze shin guards, because if you're going to be fighting on the battlefield, it's going to require a lot of running. And so you have a covering on the front of your shins to protect you from all kinds of damage from a spear cast or an arrow shot, but nothing on the back. So no covering for any of the backside of your person, because you can't, of course, be running away from conflict.
Exactly right. Are you feeling particularly well-grieved today?
No, I'm not well-grieved.
No, me either. I mean, No. That's part of it's part of my problem today.
Yeah. One of many, I'm sure, there, Jeff.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
And so Hector goes out to battle, and Achilles is too fast, and Achilles begins to chase Hector, and this chase goes on for a long time,
yes.
This chase scene.
Round and round and round the walls of Troy.
Yes, and at the start of this chase, Hector is receiving a fair amount of divine aid.
That's right.
Apollo is helping him.
Exactly.
Because he
right.
is one of Apollo's favorites. But eventually, that divine help runs out.
That's right.
And Achilles catches up with him.
That's right. So it's echoes of the death of Patroclus that we were just talking about, where gods that are in the mix helping and moving things around now turn against you. And so Hector is abandoned by the gods, again, by the decree of fate. We know. I mean, this is not a surprise ending. Homer has telegraphed this throughout. And Hector realizes too. His wife knows, his infant son on some level knows that dad's not coming back.
That's right. So Apollo has tricked Hector into going outside the walls of Troy, somewhere near the Scaean gates, to meet Achilles. Now Hector is outside the walls, as you said. His wife Andromache, whose name very interestingly means man of war.
That's right.
His wife Andromache and his son Astyanax, lord of the city.
Yes.
Are inside, and in fact they won't find out about the death of Hector until they see his body being dragged around the walls.
Brutal. Very absolutely brutal. Yes.
Achilles approaches, and he and Hector run 3 times around the walls, 3 being the number of completion. So the circuit of the walls as Achilles chases Hector. Apollo helps Hector 1 last time, giving him speed equal to Achilles. Athena intervenes, taking the form of Hector's brother Deiphobus, and promises to help Hector. So all the gods are conspiring in the deception of Hector so that Achilles can catch him and kill him according to fate.
Do you think the Greeks would have seen Hector's running as cowardice?
I don't think so, because it's divinely inspired, and because Achilles is such a force of nature that any reasonable person runs in his presence.
Right, exactly. But there is certainly the sense of he's putting off the inevitable, right? We all know that's going to come down to his death.
That's right. At one point, Hector realizes that the gods have tricked him, that he is all alone, that Athena and Apollo have abandoned him, and that his day has come, and Achilles will dispatch him. His last prayer is that he prays that his body will be returned for burial.
Yeah, it's a brutal scene. The scene where Hector he's all alone on the battle. I think in a future episode, we might talk about the movie Troy, but I think it's one of those scenes that the film got right. That sense of complete abandonment.
Hmm.
Everyone has left him.
Hector, played by another Australian, Eric Bana.
Eric Bana.
Whom you may remember from The Hulk.
Was he the Hulk?
Yes, he was.
I thought Ed Norton was the Hulk.
He was also the Hulk.
Okay. There have been a few Hulks.
There was Mark...
Ruffalo.
Was the Hulk.
I guess when they get all kind of bloated and beefy, it doesn't really matter who's in
I think you're cast in one of the future Hulk roles. Anybody
Ouch.
Can be the Hulk.
Man, zing.
So, Jeff, you have a little bit of that to read for us about the death of Hector here at the end of book 22?
I do. So Achilles drives his spear through Hector's neck. But leaves the windpipe and voice box intact so we can have some final words here. And so Phaedalus translates, godlike Achilles gloried over him. Hector, surely you thought when you stripped Patroclus' armor that you would be safe. Never a fear of me, far from the fighting as I was, you fool. Left behind there down by the beaked ships, his great avenger waited, a greater man by far, and that man was I, and I smashed your strength. And you, the dogs and birds, will maul you, shame your corpse, while Achaeans bury my dear friend in glory. And here's Hector's last words. Struggling for breath, Hector, his helmet flashing, said, I beg you. Beg you by your life, your parents, don't let the dogs devour me by the Argive ships. Wait. Take the princely ransom of bronze and gold, the gifts my father and noble mother will give you. But give my body to my friends to carry home again, so Trojan men and Trojan women can do me honor with fitting rites of fire once I am dead.
But does this move Achilles?
No.
To pity in any way?
No, he is like the flint rock, I think, is... the epic simile that Homer uses. He's like a rock of flint. He can't be swayed, he can't be persuaded or touched, even by Hector's dying speech.
Right, and in these final books, too, his rage has gotten to the point where even the world around him starts to kind of blur into this weirdness. He fights with a river.
Right.
His horses are prophesying and speaking.
Right.
The whole world is being laid waste by Achilles' rage, such that kind of the ordinary categories of inanimate and animate start to break down.
So this is really interesting that it's the anger, the first word in the epic, once again, the manen, has now taken on such a life of its own. Even though Achilles starts from a noble motive, right? He wasn't pulled back into the battle because he wanted any of the bribes Agamemnon offered in Book 9. He's pulled back into the battle because of love for his friend and a desire to revenge his friend. Now, we might... being moderns, we might quarrel with revenge as a motive, but the revenge is driven by his love for Patroclus.
That's right.
So he comes back to the battlefield, and then rage takes over.
Right.
And how is that expressed in his treatment of Hector's body?
Well, it's one of the most famous bits here is that not only he's not content with simply killing Hector and taking the revenge and the death of that man.
Taking his Rolex.
Right, exactly. Stripping the body and piling it up outside his tent. We've already learned the stuff part doesn't matter to Achilles anymore. But what he does is he takes Hector's body and lashes it behind his chariot and drags it around.
He takes leather thongs, he drills a hole in Hector's heel, and he attaches these leather thongs through Hector's heels and then ties it to the back of his chariot.
Yeah.
And drags the body of Hector 9 days around the walls of Troy.
Right. And of course the drilling of the holes through the is of course I think foreshadows the way in which Achilles will die beyond the action of the epic, right? But I that detail, the thought that goes into that desecration of the body is in my mind is more horrific than the act itself.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But what happens to Hector's body? Because the gods step in at this point,
right?
And they try to put a kind of, and succeed in putting a barrier on Achilles' hubris.
That's right. Achilles hangs on to the body, He keeps it in his tent at night, but it's going to be the vehicle by which ultimately Achilles sets his rage aside.
And it doesn't decay.
Right.
An important element. The gods make it so that despite this incredibly harsh treatment at the hands of Achilles, the body of Hector remains pristine.
Divinely embalmed.
Yep, yes. And intact. Nothing happens to it.
Right.
The gods have the best mortuary service in the universe.
Right. But it's still...
You can laugh at that, Jeff, if you want to. Not that funny, but you can laugh at it.
I was laughing at your facial expression. It's still, I think, part of the surreality of the end here. The fact that he has this divinely embalmed body that he's keeping underneath his bed. I mean, it's the creepiness and the oddity of it, I think, is also, I think Homer serves to kind of underline that this is not the way things are supposed to be.
Definitely not. It is surreal. What is surrealism, by the way?
Surrealism, I would explain it in terms of ordinary categories of understanding and definition and boundaries begin to break down.
Maybe I have a joke to illustrate surrealism.
Oh, please do.
So how many surrealists does it take to change a light bulb?
Tell us.
Potato. I bet you didn't see that coming.
I did not see it coming at all. Exactly. I would have picked a different vegetable.
But right.
Yeah. This gets us to the last book, right?
Hector's dead, body dragged.
Body dragged.
We skip over 23.
Yeah. What happens in 23?
Some important things I'm not remembering.
Exactly. Lots of scuttlebutt.
Here's an assignment for the ad nauseum listeners. Go read book 23 and report back to us.
Tell us what's in there.
That's
exactly. Right.
3,000 words, double spaced. MLA style, Times New Roman, 12-inch.
Yes, annotated.
Right.
Yes. But so you might say the climactic scene in the Iliad is the duel between Hector and Achilles, but this is not the end of the book.
And it's not the most important thing to Homer.
It's not. It's not exactly. And as we've been mentioning, it comes back to that first word, once again, the mane and the rage. When he kills Hector, the rage is still there. And so what has to happen is what we have to learn is, what happens for the rage to finally go away? And that's what we get in book 24. So what happens?
So in book 24, Priam, the father of Hector, the father of many of the famous heroes at Troy, because he and his wife Hecuba, they have together 50 sons and 50 daughters.
Yes.
A large family.
Big family.
Priam decides, I have to get back the body of my son Hector. The only way to do this is to enter the camp of the Greeks at night.
That's right.
And he's not going to get safe passage. He's not going to get any promises of safety coming to and from the camp. So here the gods step in once more.
That's right. There's no diplomatic immunity for the king.
Absolutely not. And
the way I read it, too, is that it's in some sense, Priam even knows at some level that he's likely not coming back alive.
That's right.
Right?
Peter O'Toole in the Troy movie.
Oh yeah,
plays the character of Priam and does a really good job.
Yes,
I would say
the vulnerability of the
that's right.
Of the man.
Choose the scenery.
Exactly right. So who do the gods send?
They send Hermes.
Why Hermes? Why does that?
Well, Hermes,
make sense?
His role among the gods is that he is the psychopomp.
That's right.
The psychopomp, if you will, which means the guide of souls. So Hermes carries a special staff called a caduceus or a caduceus. This staff is got snakes wrapped around it. It's what's called a chthonic symbol.
Yes.
Which is something that gives you special access to the underworld. The
right.
Greek word chthon meaning earth. So Hermes carries this chthonic symbol, this staff, and he is the one who can go down into the underworld and bring souls up. Or accompany them down to the underworld. He's the escort.
That's exactly right. So a lot of our listeners might know Hermes primarily as a messenger deity, but this is all kind of part of that extended identity. He's a boundary crosser.
That's right.
And one of the things that makes him a good messenger is that he can unlock doors to many planes of existence.
He's also, incidentally, the god of thieves.
Yes.
This always strikes my students as quite odd. The god of thieves? And so I always say to them, look, if you're a thief, that doesn't mean you're irreligious, right? You're still going to pray to the gods, right? You're going to pray that there would be no German shepherds, right? That the ADT would be off, whatever it is. So
yeah.
So thieves pray to Hermes.
Exactly. And then you consider, throw into that the kind of the Greek premium on cleverness.
That's right.
The best thieves are going to be the most clever. And Hermes is, of the gods, one of them that's quick with a joke. Right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Or a light of your smoke.
Light up a smoke. Exactly right. A little Billy Joel reference.
That's right. But there's some place that you'd rather be.
Yes.
And for Priam, it's in the tent of Achilles.
That's right.
So Hermes conducts him through the Greek camp and delivers him into Achilles' tent.
Yes.
And what's happening there?
Well, Achilles is like we said earlier, he's there and in his tent and under his bed is Hector's body.
Hmm.
Right. And so...
Perfectly preserved. But not where it's supposed to be.
Not where it's supposed to be, right. So Priam, like we said, probably expecting the man just to draw a sword and kill him on the spot.
It was a death mission, really.
It was a death mission, right. And an incredibly, powerfully brave act. One of the most, to my mind, one of the most moving scenes in the whole epic, in terms of the bravery of this old man.
Yes.
Who's lost everything.
And Priam's name itself means ransom. Yes, because when Hercules was killing off his family for a slight, Athena intervened to save Priam so that the dynasty would continue.
That's right.
So Priam's name itself means the one who was ransomed, who was redeemed from a sudden death. Now we have Priam in the tent of Achilles, and I'm going to read from the Ian Johnston translation, just to throw another one into the mix.
Sure.
Ian Johnston is a really amazingly industrious translator.
And he's got a lot of great stuff free online.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I reference it quite often because it's not the most beautiful, no offense, but it's really highly accurate and thorough, exhaustive. There's so much there. So he says this. This is Priam speaking to Achilles. Godlike Achilles, remember your own father, who's as old as me, on the painful threshold of old age. It may well be that those who live around him are harassing him, and no one's there to save him from ruin and destruction. So, Achilles, show deference to the gods and pity for myself, remembering your own father. Of the two old men, I'm more pitiful, because I have endured what no living mortal on this earth has borne. I've lifted up to my own lips and kissed the hands of the man who killed my son.
Brutal. So moving and tragic, yes.
Because in wartime, as Homer says, in wartime, even though war is in some ways the natural order, in wartime the natural order is somewhat reversed. Because what's supposed to happen is that sons bury their fathers.
Yes.
Fathers die of old age and sons bury them. But in time of war, it's the opposite. Fathers bury their sons.
Right.
And this is what Priam wants to do. Give me back the body of Hector so that I can pay him this last honor, as simple as it is.
Right. And it also strikes me that in some ways, Priam, he begs Achilles to remember his own father. Right. And so if we were talking about book 9 in the previous episode, Phoenix kind of stands in that spot, also kind of reminding Achilles of his own father, and it's almost as if like Phoenix's speech in book 9, which was kind of theoretical. They're safe in the tent. They're kind of talking about things. Now it kind of hits Achilles in this very real kind of way, in this very visceral kind of way. He's got the body of somebody under his bed.
Yeah.
And so it finally that idea, that thought, kind of bears fruit and really hits Achilles.
The notion of filial piety.
Yes.
Right? That the relationship between father and son is, in some ways, a very primal bond. This will become, of course, very important later in the Aeneid, but it's on full display here.
And Phagels says, following that speech of Priam, says, you know, those words stirred within Achilles a deep desire to grieve for his own father.
Mm.
Right. And that's where really everything changes.
Mm. So is Achilles a noble character? Achilles is not induced by bribes, by... wealth, by all these towns, by sex, by these women. He won't go back to fight, but he'll fight for Patroclus,
right.
Friendship, and he'll eventually surrender, at least in a little way, in some sense, he'll surrender to Priam.
Right. Yeah. Is Achilles noble? I mean, I think he's maddeningly human. I think that's really the beauty of the poem. Achilles as a character is impossible to pin down. He's a complex, you know, conflict of things going on, and he doesn't it doesn't serve the reader well to kind of reduce him to kind of either kind of a black hat, white hat kind of character. This whole poem is filled with gray areas.
Yeah, I really like the final quote here. This is also Ian Johnston. It plays right into what you said. Here Achilles is making his reply to Priam, and he says, "Old man, don't provoke me. I myself intend to give you Hector. Zeus sent me here a messenger, the mother who bore me, daughter of the old man of the sea. And in my heart, Priam, I recognize, it's no secret to me, that some god led you here to the swift Achaean ships. No matter how young and strong, no living man would dare to make the trip to our encampment. He could not evade the sentries or push back our door bolts. That would not be easy." So Achilles says, I know that you came here under divine guidance and orchestration. I'm going to give you back Hector's body. I'll do it. No problem. But then he adds this, don't agitate my grieving heart still more, or I might not spare even you, old man.
Right.
Achilles can't resist throwing in a threat.
Yeah.
I'll give you back Hector, but stop importuning me with this speech, or yeah. I might kill you as well.
It's not handshakes and hugs from here on out. No,
there's absolutely not.
That brutal knife edge nature of Achilles is still on full display, right?
So what is the absolute end of the epic as we wrap up the artistic elements of the Iliad?
It's Hector's funeral. And like we said early on, Achilles very much alive at the end of this story. His death is yet to come. The Trojan horse is yet to come.
What's a Greek funeral like? Is it mourning and casseroles and so forth?
There might be some chines.
Okay.
Maybe a chine-based casserole. But the way you celebrate the life of a hero like Patroclus, like Hector, and kind of beyond the action of Achilles, is you compete.
Athletics once again?
Athletics once again. It's the agone.
Right.
It's another chance for people to show how good they are.
I've given similar instructions to my own family.
How so?
Well, that at my funeral, I want there to be a number of different competitions.
Have you given thought, like what kind of competition?
Feats of strength.
Really? Bowling?
Bowling could be one. Yeah. Feats of strength, a little dart throw.
Really?
Yeah, sure. Foot race.
Yeah?
This would be the best way to honor someone you love is to have some good old-fashioned competition.
Absolutely.
Some athletics.
Exactly. Casseroles?
No casserole.
Is it going to be a casserole-free funeral for you? Or?
I don't know.
Yeah. So that brings us to the end. We did it. We made it to the end.
We made it through.
Yes. And the very last line of the Iliad in Fagel's translation is something along the lines of, thus the Trojans buried Hector, the breaker of horses.
Hmm.
And that's it. So the last line itself is not even about Achilles. It's about Hector.
It's given to Hector.
It's the funeral that finally brings Achilles, at least temporarily, his maiden, to a close.
There are so many noble characters in the Iliad. One of my favorites, of course, is Andromache, the wife of Hector.
Yeah.
Hector himself is another favorite, as well as Diomedes. Odysseus, not so fond of him in the Iliad, although he'll loom large, of course, in the epic named after him, and he's much more winsome there.
Yes, exactly. He gets more kind of room to breathe and
right.
and show the aspects of his character.
And yeah. Do you have a favorite?
A favorite character in the Iliad?
We talked about this a little bit in one of the earlier episodes,
right.
But now that we've taken the listeners through it, it's maybe appropriate
yeah.
to revisit it.
Right. No, I'm always, again, time and again, drawn to Hector as a man. Just the tragic nature of his fate, the weight of his city and his people and his family that he puts on his shoulders. Those moments when he's running away from Achilles. Staving off the inevitable. It's brutal, but it's also deeply moving.
Mm. Running from certain death.
A man running from certain death, and his last words to Achilles, it just kind of. Hector recognizes the importance for his family that his body be returned. Thinking of his family in those last moments, it's wonderful, wonderfully tragic. Yeah.
All right, so that finishes up the Iliad. We hope that listeners will tune in next week when we start to look at the Minoans and the Mycenaeans, the archaeological precedent, the historical precedent for these events. Jeff, you have a nice quote to put a bow on all of this for today?
Yes, I do. Another one of our gustatory-related quotes to take us out, and this is from the inimitable Mark Twain, who once wrote, "The secret of success in life is to eat what you like and let the food fight it out inside."
Ad nauseam.
Ad nauseam.